illiteracy laws, bans on the mails, and the suppression of speakers. An aversion to political debate also structured the Confederacy, which had both a distinctive character and a lasting influence on Americans' ideas about federal authority as against popular sovereignty. Secessionists were attempting to build a modern, pro-slavery, anti-democratic state. In order to wage a war, the leaders of this fundamentally anti-democratic state needed popular support. Such support was difficult to gain and impossible to maintain. The Confederacy, therefore, suppressed dissent. "The people have, with unexampled unanimity, resolved to secede," one South Carolina convention delegate wrote in his diary. But this was wishful thinking. 7 states of the Lower South seceded before Lincoln's inauguration, but the 8 states of the Upper South refused to do the same, and even in the Lower South, the choice to secede was not a simple one, nor was it an easy victory. The most ardent supporters of secession were the wealthiest plantation owners. The least ardent were the great majority of white male voters, poor men who did not own slaves. The most effective way to persuade these men to support secession was to argue that even though they didn't own slaves, their lives were made better by the existence of the institution, since it meant that they were spared the most demeaning work. Pro-secessionists made this argument repeatedly and with growing intensity. James D.B. DeBow's "The Interest in Slavery of the Southern Non-Slaveholder," 1860, was widely excerpted in newspapers, reminding poor men that no white man in the South serves another as a body servant to clean his boots, wait on his table, and perform the menial services of his household. Nevertheless, rather than trusting a decision about secession to the voters, or even to a ratifying convention, Georgia legislator Thomas R.R. Cobb advised his legislature to make the decision itself. "Wait not till the grog shops and crossroads shall send up a discordant voice from a divided people." When Georgia did hold a convention, its delegates were deeply split. The secessionists cooked the numbers in order to ensure their victory and proceeded to require all delegates to sign a pledge supporting secession, even if they had voted against it. One of the first things the new state of Georgia did was to pass a law that made dissent punishable by death. As hard as secessionists fought for popular support, and as aggressively as they suppressed dissent, they were nevertheless only partially successful. 4 states in the Upper South only seceded after Confederate forces fired on U.S. troops at Fort Sumter, South Carolina, on April 12th. Even then, Virginia kept on stalling, until on April 17th, Governor Henry Wise walked into the Virginia Convention and took out his pistol and said that by his order, Virginia was now at war with the federal government, and that if anyone wanted to shoot him for treason, they'd have to wrestle his pistol away from him first. The convention voted 88-55 to recommend secession. That went to the state's electorate on May 23rd, which voted 125,950 to 20,373 in favor. Most who opposed it were in the western part of the state. In June, they held their own convention and effectively seceded from the state to become West Virginia. 4 more states in the Upper South still refused to secede, even as the cords that tied the nation together were being cut. Telegraph wires were only first stretching all the way across the American continent. The first message sent from east to west had read, "May the Union be perpetuated." But after the firing on Fort Sumter, Lincoln ordered the telegraph wires connecting Washington to the South severed. By May of 1861, the Confederacy comprised 15 states, stretching over 900,000 square miles and containing 12 million people, including 4 million slaves and 4 million white women who were disenfranchised. It rested on the foundational belief that a minority governs a majority. "The condition of slavery is with us nothing but a form of civil government for a class of people not fit to govern themselves," said Jefferson Davis. The Civil War inaugurated a new kind of war, with giant armies wielding unstoppable machines, as if monsters with scales of steel had been let loose on the land to maul and maraud, and to eat even the innocent. When the war began, both sides expected it to be limited and brief. Instead, it was vast and long, 4 brutal, wretched years of misery on a scale never before seen. In campaigns of singular ferocity, 2.1 million Northerners battled 880,000 Southerners in more than 200 battles. More than 750,000 Americans died. Twice as many died from disease as from wounds. They died in heaps. They were buried in pits. Fewer than 2,000 Americans had died in battle during the entire war with Mexico. In a single battle of the Civil War at Shiloh, Tennessee, in 1862, there were 24,000 casualties. Soldiers were terrified of being left behind or lost among the unnamed, unburied, unremembered dead. One soldier from South Carolina wrote home, "I have a horror of being thrown out in a neglected place or be trampled on." On battlefields, the dead and dying were found clutching photographs of their wives and children. After yet another slaughter, Union General Ulysses S. Grant said a man could walk across the battlefield in any direction as far as he could see without touching the ground, but only the dead. Fields where once waved stalks of corn and wheat yielded harvests of nothing but suffering and death, or falling fallow, nothing but graves. All of this, each misery, its grand scale, for the first time in history, was captured on camera, archived, displayed, exhibited. 1,000 photographers produced hundreds of thousands of photographs on battlefield after battlefield. After the first major battle fought in the North in Maryland, the worst day in American military history, with 26,000 Confederate and Union soldiers killed, wounded, or captured, or missing, Matthew Brady, in his National Photographic Portrait Gallery on the corner of New York's 10th Street and Broadway, opened The Dead of Antietam, an exhibit of photographs of the carnage taken by a Scottish immigrant named Alexander Gardner. "Mr. Brady has done something to bring home to us the terrible reality and earnestness of war," the New York Times reported. "If he has not brought bodies and laid them in our dooryards and along the streets, he has done something very like it." On a scorched Wednesday, July 1st, 1863, the turning point in the war came at the Battle of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. By the third day of fighting, each side had lost more than 20,000 men, and the Confederate general, the 56-year-old Virginian Robert E. Lee, began his retreat. 5,000 horses, fallen, were burned to stop their rotting, the smoke of those fires mingling with the steam that rose from the fetid remains of unburied men. Samuel Wilkerson, a reporter for the New York Times, went to report on the battle and found that his oldest son, a lieutenant, had been wounded in the leg and had died after his surgeons abandoned him when Confederates neared the barn where they were attempting an amputation. On July 4th, America's 87th birthday, Wilkerson buried his son and filed his report. "O you dead who died at Gettysburg, have baptized with your blood the second birth of freedom in America," he wrote in agony before supplying his readers with a list of the dead and wounded. The next day, Alexander Gardner and two of his team showed up with their cameras and took shots, from which Gardner made 87 photographs, a field of ghosts. They lay in trenches, they lay on hilltops, they lay between trees, they lay atop rocks. Gardner gathered them together in a book of the dead, Gardner's photographic sketchbook of the war, America's first book of photographs. Gardner had been an abolitionist, and the book included photographs of the dead and dying, but it included, too, scenes of towns and streets and scenes that told the story of slavery. On a brick building of a trading house was printed, "Price, Birch and Company, Dealers and Slaves." Gardner titled it, "Slave Pen, Alexandria, Virginia." Gardner was a Union soldier, his camera, his weapon. 4 months after the carnage, Lincoln set out for Gettysburg. Thousands of bodies had lain, barely covered by dirt. Hogs rutting in the fields had dug up arms and legs and heads. But with caskets provided by the War Department, the corpses had been uncovered, sorted, and cataloged. A third had been reburied. The rest waited. Lincoln had been invited to dedicate their burial. After an 80-mile train ride, he arrived in Pennsylvania at dusk to find coffins still stacked at the station. The next morning, still in mourning for his own young son, he rode at the head of a march of 100 men astride horses. The oration that day was given by Edward Everett. Lincoln, offering a dedication, spoke for a mere 3 minutes, with a scant 272 words, delivered slowly in his broad Kentucky accent. He renewed the American experiment. He spoke first of the dead. "We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that this nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this." "But a cemetery is not only a field for the dead," he said. "It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here, to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from this earth. He did not mention slavery. There would be those after the war ended who said that it had been fought over states' rights or to preserve the Union or for 1,000 other reasons and causes. Soldiers north and south knew better. The fact that slavery is the sole undeniable cause of this infamous rebellion, that it is a war of, by, and for slavery, is as plain as the noonday sun, a soldier writing for his Wisconsin regimental newspaper explained in 1862. Any man who pretends to believe that this is not a war for the emancipation of blacks, a soldier writing for his Confederate Brigade's newspaper wrote that same year, is either a fool or a liar. By then, the emancipation had begun. 3. It was an American odyssey. They came at night when the flickering campfires shone like vast unsteady stars along the black horizon. W.E.B. Du Bois later wrote, "Old men and thin, with gray and tufted hair, women with frightened eyes, dragging, whimpering, hungry children, men and girls, stalwart and gaunt. They came to in daylight and on horseback, by wagon and cart. They clambered aboard trains, they packed food and stole guns, they walked and they ran and they rode, carrying their children on their backs, dedicating themselves to the unfinished work of the nation, freeing themselves." The Civil War was a revolutionary war of emancipation. The exodus began even before the first shots were fired, but the closer the Union Army drew, the more people fled. The families who lived on Jefferson Davis's 1,000-acre cotton plantation, Briarfield, with its colonnaded mansion in Mississippi, just south of Vicksburg, began leaving early in 1862. Another 137 people left Briarfield after the fall of Vicksburg and headed to Chickasaw Bayou, a Union camp. Confederate Secretary of State Robert Toombs had boasted that the Confederacy would win the war and that he would one day call a roll of slaves at Bunker Hill. Wrote one newspaper reporter after the arrival of Davis's former slaves at Chickasaw Bayou, "The President of the Confederate States may call the roll of his slaves at Richmond, at Natchez, or at Niagara, but the answer will not come." Lincoln announced on September 22, 1862, in a preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, that he would free nearly every slave held in every Confederate state in exactly 100 days, on New Year's Day, 1863. He'd planned the announcement for a long time, wrestling with his conscience. "I said nothing to anyone," he later told his cabinet, "but I made the promise to myself and to my Maker." Across the land, people fell to their knees. Frederick Douglass said that the war had at last been invested with sanctity. In New York, Horace Greeley declared that in all ages there had been no act of one man and of one people so sublime as this emancipation. The New York Times deemed the proclamation as important as the Constitution. "Breath alone kills no rebels," Lincoln cautioned. But a crowd of black men, women, and children nevertheless came to the White House and serenaded him, singing hosannas. The announcement set the South on fire. The Richmond Examiner called the promised Emancipation Proclamation the most startling political crime, the most stupid political blunder yet known in American history. 15,000 copies of the proclamation having been printed, the news made its way within days to slaves, whispered through windows, shouted across fields. Isaac Lane swiped a newspaper from his master's mail and read it out loud to every slave he could find. Not everyone was willing to wait as long as 100 days. In October, men caught planning a rebellion in Culpeper, Virginia, were found to have in their possession newspapers in which the proclamation had been printed. 17 of those men were killed. Their executions meant as a warning, the reign of a different hell. Frederick Douglass, who had led his people to the very gates of freedom, worried that Lincoln might abandon the pledge. "The 1st of January is to be the most memorable day in American annals," he wrote. "But will the deed be done? Oh, that is the question." The promised emancipation turned the war into a crusade. But not all of Lincoln's supporters were interested in fighting a crusade against slavery. As autumn faded to winter, pressure mounted on the president to retract the promise. He held fast. "Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history," Lincoln told Congress in December. "We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth." On Christmas Eve, day 92, a worried Charles Sumner visited the White House. Would the president make good his pledge? Lincoln offered reassurance. On December 29th, Lincoln wrote a draft of the Emancipation Proclamation to his cabinet. It did not free slaves in states that had not seceded, nor those in territory and secessionist states held by the Union Army. Cabinet members suggested an amendment urging those emancipated to forbear from tumult. This Lincoln refused to add. But Salmon Chase, Secretary of the Treasury, suggested a new ending, which Lincoln did adopt. "I invoke the considerate judgment of all mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God." On day 96, Douglas declared, "The cause of human freedom and the cause of our common country are now one and inseparable." 97, 98, 99, New Year's Eve 1862, watch night. The eve of what would come to be called the Day of Days. In the Capitol, crowds of African Americans filled the streets. In Norfolk, Virginia, 4,000 slaves who living in a border state that was not part of the Confederacy were not actually freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, paraded through the streets with fifes and drums, imitating the Sons of Liberty. In New York, Henry Highland Garnett, the black abolitionist, preached to an overflow crowd at the Shiloh Presbyterian Church. At exactly 11:55 p.m., the church fell silent. The parishioners sat in the cold and the stillness, counting those final minutes, each tick of the clock. At midnight, the choir broke the silence. "Blow, ye trumpets, blow, the year of Jubilee has come." On the streets of the city, the people sang another song. "Cry out and shout, all ye children of sorrow. The gloom of your midnight hath passed away." 100. On January 1, 1863, sometime after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Lincoln held the Emancipation Proclamation in his hand and picked up his pen. He said solemnly, "I never in my life felt more certain that I was doing right than I do in signing this paper." In South Carolina, the proclamation was read out to the 1st South Carolina Volunteer Infantry, a regiment of former slaves. At its final lines, the soldiers began to sing, quietly at first, and then louder, "My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing." American slavery had lasted for centuries. It had stolen the lives of millions and crushed the souls of millions more. It had cut down children, stricken mothers, and broken men. It had poisoned a people and a nation. It had turned hearts to stone. It had made eyes blind. It had left gaping wounds and terrible scars. It was not over yet, but at last, an end lay within sight. The American Odyssey had barely begun. From cabins and fields they left, freedmen and women. Freedmen and women didn't always head north. They often went south or west, traveling hundreds of miles by foot, on horseback, on stage, and by train, searching. There were husbands in search of wives, wives in search of husbands. Mothers and fathers looking for their children, children for their parents, chasing word and rumors about where their loved ones had been sold, sail after sail, across the country. Some of their wanderings lasted for years. They sought their own union, a union of their beloved. "Men of color, to arms," Frederick Douglass cried on March 2, 1863, calling on black men to join the Union Army. "I urge you to fly to arms and smite with death the power that would bury the government and your liberty in the same hopeless grave." Congress had lifted a ban on blacks in the military in 1862, but with emancipation, Douglass began traveling through the North as a recruiting agent for the 54th Massachusetts Infantry, a newly formed all-black regiment. "The iron gate of our prison stands half open," Douglass wrote. "The chance is now given you to end in a day the bondage of centuries." The Confederacy, meanwhile, had called its own men to arms, instituting the first draft in American history. The Union had soon followed, instituting a draft of its own. In July 1863, white New Yorkers, furious at being called to fight what was plainly a war of emancipation, protested the draft during 5 days of violent riots that mainly involved attacking the city's blacks. 11 men were lynched, and the more than 200 children at the colored orphan asylum only barely escaped when the building was set on fire. The Confederate draft called on as many as 85% of white men between the ages of 18 and 35, a much broader swath of the population than served in the Union Army. 70% of Union soldiers were unmarried. The Confederate draft drew on married men, leaving their families at risk of destitution and starvation. "I have no head to my family," one Confederate woman wrote in 1863, the year the Confederate government also passed a 1/10 tax, requiring citizens to give 10% of everything grown or raised on farms to the state. Near the end of the war, the Confederate government, its army desperately short of both men and supplies, decided to do what had been for so long unthinkable. It began enlisting slaves as soldiers, to the great dismay of many Confederate soldiers, who'd been urged to fight to protect their rights as whites. One private from North Carolina wrote home to his mother, "I did not volunteer my services to fight for a free Negro's free country, but to fight for a free white man's free country." The Civil War expanded the powers of the federal government by precedents set in both the North and in the South that included not only conscription, but also a federal currency, income taxes, and welfare programs. The Union, faced with paying for the war against the Confederacy, borrowed from banks, and when money ran short, recklessly printed it, producing a federal tender, the greenback. The House Ways and Means Committee considered levying a tax on land, willing to take the risk that such a measure would eventually be struck down as unconstitutional because a land tax is a direct tax. But Schuyler Colfax, a Republican from Indiana, objected. "I cannot go home and tell my constituents that I voted for a bill that would allow a man, a millionaire, who has put his entire property into stock, to be exempt from taxation, while a farmer, who lives by his side, must pay a tax." A tax on income seemed a reasonable and less regressive alternative. A number of states, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Alabama, North Carolina, South Carolina, Maryland, and Florida, already taxed income. And Britain had partly funded the Crimean War by doing the same. Unlike a tax on real estate, an income tax was not, or at least not obviously, a direct tax prohibited by the Constitution. Income also included earnings from stocks and so didn't exempt fat cats. In 1862, Lincoln signed a law establishing an Internal Revenue Bureau charged with administering an income tax, later turned into a graduated tax, taxing incomes of over $600 at 3% and incomes more than $10,000 at 5%. The Confederacy, reluctant to levy taxes, was never able to raise enough money to pay for the war, which is one reason the rebellion failed. Yet, ironically, the Confederacy, a government opposed to federal power, exercised it to a far greater degree than the Union. The rhetoric of war had it that Southerners were fighting to protect their homes and especially their wives, but Confederate conscription led white women in the South to protest politically. They entered the political arena with much the same fervor that Northern women had for decades demonstrated in the fight for abolition. By 1862, large numbers of soldiers' wives had begun petitioning the government, seeking relief. Mary Jones, a soldier's widow from the river town of Natchez, Mississippi, wrote to her governor, "Everybody say I must be taken care of by the Confederate States. They did not tell my dear husband that I should beg from door to door when he went to fight for his country." These disenfranchised women employed the rhetoric of wartime sacrifice as a claim to citizenship. "We have given our men." They also began organizing collectively by staging food riots. In November 1862, two petitioning women warned that the women talk of making up companies going to try to make peace, for it is more than human hearts can bear. Another woman warned the governor of North Carolina, "The time has come that we, the common people, has to have bread or blood, and we are bound, both men and women, to have it or die in the attempt." The following spring, female mobs, numbering in the hundreds and often armed with knives and guns, were involved in at least 12 violent protests. "Bread or blood," rioting women shouted in Atlanta, in Richmond, in Mobile. In Salisbury, North Carolina, Mary Moore had a message for her governor. "Our husbands and sons are now separated from us by the cruel war, not only to defend their humbly homes, but the homes and property of the rich men." In the end, the petitions written and protests staged by white Confederate women contributed to the creation of a new system of public welfare. Relief for soldiers' wives, a state welfare system bigger than anywhere in the Union. The rise of the modern welfare system is often traced to the pension system instituted for Union veterans in the 1870s, but it was the Confederacy and Southern white women that laid its foundation. The war was not yet won and emancipation not yet achieved. As late as the summer of 1862, in the last weeks before the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln had insisted that the purpose of the war was to save the Union. "If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it," he wrote Horace Greeley. "And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that." But by 1864, he had wholly changed his mind. Victory without abolition would be no victory at all. Emancipation Proclamation had freed all slaves within the Confederate states, but it had not freed slaves in the border states, and it had not made slavery itself impossible. That would require a constitutional amendment. While soldiers fought and fell on distant battlefields, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony knocked on doors and gathered 400,000 signatures demanding passage of the 13th Amendment prohibiting slavery in the United States. The measure was approved by the Senate 33-6 on April 8, 1864. All Senate Republicans, 3 Northern Democrats, and 5 senators from border states voted in favor. But in the House, voting weeks before the Republican National Convention was scheduled to meet in Baltimore, the amendment fell 13 votes short of the needed 2/3 majority. A war-weary Abraham Lincoln had decided to run for re-election, even though no American president had served a second term since Andrew Jackson. His supporters handed out campaign buttons, tin-type photographs of Lincoln, cased in metal. His face is sunken and craggy, as chiseled as a sea-swept rock. He lifts his chin and looks off into the distance, as if offering a promise. In the election, he confronted a meager opponent, George McClellan, an inept general whom Lincoln had relieved of his command. McClellan's support within the party was thin. At the Democratic convention in August, a display outside the hall, coiled gas pipe with jets that were meant to ignite and spell out the words, "McClellan, our only hope," failed and only sputtered as helplessly as the candidate. 3 months later, Lincoln won 55% of the popular vote, the greatest margin since Jackson's re-election in 1828. His most sweeping victory came from the Union Army. 70% of soldiers voted for him. Instead of voting for their former commander, McClellan, they cast their votes for Lincoln and for emancipation. After the election, Lincoln pressed the House for passage of the 13th Amendment by lobbying senators from border states. "We can never have an entire peace in this country as long as the institution of slavery remains," said James S. Rollins of Missouri, a former slave owner. When the amendment finally passed by the required 2/3 majority on January 31, 1865, 119-56, the hall, for a moment, fell silent, and then members of Congress sank to their seats and wept like children. Outside, a 100-gun salute announced the result. From the battlefield, one black Union soldier wrote, "America has washed her hands at the clear spring of freedom." Only time would tell whether the water from that spring could ever clean the stain of slavery. Rain fell in Washington for weeks that winter as winds slashed the city, uprooting trees as if the very weather were bringing the cruelty of war to the Capitol. On the morning of Lincoln's inauguration, March 4th, the crowds came armed with umbrellas, bayoneted against the sky. They huddled in a swamp of puddles and mud. A fog fell over the city. But just as Lincoln rose to speak, the skies cleared and the sun broke through the clouds. With the heavy steps of his lumbering gait, Lincoln ascended the platform on the east front of the Capitol. Alexander Gardner captured him in a photograph of magnificent acuity. Lincoln wears no hat. He holds a sheaf of papers in his hands and looks down. He spoke but briefly. "Slavery had been the cause of the war, and yet, fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. A prayer for the living and for the dead." And then he closed with words that have since been etched into his memorial. "With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." John Wilkes Booth, 26, watched from the balcony. "What an excellent chance I had to kill the president if I had wished on Inauguration Day," he'd later say. On April 9th, in the parlor of a farmhouse in Appomattox, Virginia, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered his command to Union General Ulysses Grant. 2 days later, Booth, a well-known Shakespearean actor, stood uneasily in a crowd watching Lincoln deliver a speech in which the president explained the terms of the victory. "That means nigger citizenship," Booth muttered. 4 days and some hours after that, at about 10:15 p.m. on April 14th, Good Friday, Booth shot Lincoln with a Derringer at Ford's Theater, a playhouse 6 blocks from the White House. Lincoln slumped in a chair, a walnut rocker, unconscious. An army surgeon leapt into the president's box, laid Lincoln out on the carpeted floor, removed his shirt, and looked for the wound. He and 2 other doctors then carried the president down a staircase, out of the playhouse, and into a first-floor room in a boarding house on 10th Street. The president, 56, was not expected to survive. Hoping he might speak before dying, more than 12 people remained at his side through the night. They waited in vain. He never woke. He died in the morning, the first president of the United States to be killed while in office. Word of his death, spread by telegraph, was reported in newspapers on Saturday and mourned in churches on Sunday. "May we not have needed this loss," declared one minister, "in which we gain a national martyr." It was Easter. The death of Abraham Lincoln marked the birth of a new American creed, a religion of emancipation. It began with the mourning of a martyr. After 4 years of war, most Americans had black clothes ready to hand, the women their widows' weeds, the men their black cloaks and armbands. At the White House, the doctors who conducted the autopsy kept relics, one wrapping in paper, a splinter of bone from the skull. Lincoln had been a man of gigantic proportions, his body the subject of ceaseless fascination. The embalmers, arriving at the White House, promised, "The body of the president will never know decay." 4 days later, when the casket was put on display, vendors sold mementos as mourners gathered to get a glimpse of the dead president. "We have lost our Moses," cried one elderly black woman waiting in line. "He was crucified for us," another black mourner said in Pennsylvania. Not all Americans mourned. "Hurrah," one South Carolinian wrote in her diary, "old Abe Lincoln has been assassinated." Pallbearers carried Lincoln's casket onto a funeral train that snaked across the country through fields and towns for 12 days and nights. On May 4th, 1865, his body was carried into a temporary vault in Springfield, Illinois, until a more permanent memorial could be built, a granite obelisk above a marble sarcophagus. If he had uttered no dying words, he had left many last words, forever remembered and etched in stone. With a nation still draped in black, the 13th Amendment, Lincoln's last legacy, went to the states. When it was finally ratified on December 6, 1865, one California congressman declared, "The one question of the age is settled." A great debate had ended. A terrible war had been won. Slavery was over. But the unfinished work of a great nation remained undone. The struggle for equality had only just begun. Lincoln would remain a man trapped in time, in the click of a shutter, and by the trigger of a gun. And mourning him in sepia and yellow and black and white beneath plates of glinting glass, Americans deferred a different grief, a vaster and more dire reckoning, with centuries of suffering and loss, not captured by any camera, not settled by any amendment, the injuries wrought on the bodies of millions of men, women and children stolen, shackled, hunted, whipped, branded, raped, starved, and buried in unmarked graves. No president consecrated their cemeteries or delivered their Gettysburg Address. No committee of arrangements built monuments to their memory. With Lincoln's death, it was as if millions of people had been crammed into his tomb, trapped in a vault that could not hold them. Part 3, The State, 1866 to 1945. Decisions in a modern state tend to be made by the interaction not of Congress and the executive, but of public opinion and the executive. Walter Lippmann, The Basic Problem of Democracy, 1919. Chapter 9, Of Citizens, Persons, and People. What is a citizen? Before the Civil War, and for rather a long time afterward, the government of the United States had no certain answer to that question. I have often been pained by the fruitless search in our law books and the records of our courts for a clear and satisfactory definition of the phrase citizen of the United States. Lincoln's exasperated attorney general wrote in 1862, "In 1866, Congress charged two legal scholars with discovering the definition. The word citizen, or citizens, is found 10 times at least in the Constitution of the United States," one scholar wrote to the other, "and no definition is given anywhere." Congress raised the question while deliberating over the consequences of emancipation. Millions of people once held as slaves had been freed. What it would mean for them to become citizens would depend in part on the meaning of citizen. On this score, the Constitution proved maddeningly vague, referring to citizenship chiefly as a requirement for running for office and in relation to the status of immigrants. Article 2, Section 1 decreed, "No person except a natural-born citizen or a citizen of the United States at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall be eligible to the office of president." But even so seemingly straightforward a statement turned out to be murky. The words "natural-born" were added only at the last minute without recorded debate, after John Jay wrote a letter to George Washington suggesting that it might be wise and seasonable to provide a strong check to the admission of foreigners into the administration of our national government, and to declare expressly that the commander-in-chief of the American army shall not be given to, nor devolve on, any but a natural-born citizen. What and who is a natural-born citizen? Jay didn't say. Under English common law, a natural-born subject is a person born within the king's realm, or, depending on the circumstances, outside the king's realm, but to the king's subjects. A natural-born citizen, though, isn't quite the same thing as a natural-born subject, not least because most U.S. laws did not discriminate between natural-born and naturalized citizens, since Americans, immigrants, and the children of immigrants rejected the fealty of blood. In Federalist No. 52, Madison explained that anyone interested in running for Congress need only have been a U.S. citizen for 7 years because the door of this part of the federal government is open to merit of every description, whether native or adoptive, whether young or old, and without regard to poverty or wealth or to any particular profession of religious faith. People running for Congress didn't have to meet property requirements, they didn't have to have been born in the United States, and they couldn't be subject to religious tests. This same logic applied to citizenship, and for the same reason. The framers of the Constitution understood these sorts of requirements as forms of political oppression. The door to the United States was meant to be open. Before the 1880s, no federal law restricted immigration. And despite periods of fervent nativism, especially in the 1840s, the United States welcomed immigrants into citizenship and valued them. After the Civil War, the U.S. Treasury estimated the worth of each immigrant as equal to an $800 contribution to the nation's economy, eliciting a protest from Levi Morton, a congressman from New York, that this amount was far too low. On the floor of Congress, Morton asked, "What estimate can we place upon the value to the country of the millions of Irishmen and Germans to whom we largely owe the existence of the great arteries of commerce extending from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and the results of that industry and skill which have so largely contributed to the wealth and property of the country?" Plainly, whatever else could be said of American citizenship, the idea was both liberal and capacious. Article 4, Section 2 of the Constitution established that citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states, a stipulation that Alexander Hamilton believed to be the basis of the Union. A citizen of one state was the equal of a citizen from another state. But what made these people citizens? Under what conditions were residents not citizens? And what exactly were the privileges and immunities of citizenship? 19th-century politicians and political theorists interpreted American citizenship within the context of an emerging set of ideas about human rights and the authority of the state, holding dear the conviction that a good government guarantees everyone eligible for citizenship the same set of political rights, equal and irrevocable. Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner stated this view squarely in 1849 while discussing the Constitution of his home state. Here is the great charter of every human being drawing vital breath upon this soil, whatever may be his condition, and whoever may be his parents. He may be poor, weak, humble, or black. He may be of Caucasian, Jewish, Indian, or Ethiopian race. He may be of French, German, English, or Irish extraction. But before the Constitution of Massachusetts, all these distinctions disappear. He is a man, the equal of all his fellow men. He is one of the children of the state, which, like an impartial parent, regards all of its offspring with an equal care. The practice fell short of the ideal. On the one hand, all citizens, whether natural-born or naturalized, were eligible to run for Congress. No federal laws restricted immigration, and all citizens were, at least theoretically, political equals. But on the other hand, no small number of laws and customs restricted citizenship. The Naturalization Act, passed in 1798, extended the residency period required for an immigrant to become a citizen from 5 to 14 years. That period was set back to 5 years in 1802, but under the terms of a law that declared that only a free white person could become a citizen. In 1857, in Dred Scott, the Supreme Court considered the question of black citizenship, asking, "Can a Negro whose ancestors were imported into this country and sold as slaves become a member of that political community formed and brought into existence by the Constitution of the United States, and as such become entitled to all the rights and privileges and immunities guaranteed by that instrument to the citizen?" Its resounding answer was no. And the citizenship of women was of such a limited scope that in 1859, Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote bitterly to Susan B. Anthony, "When I pass the gate of the Celestials, and good Peter asks me where I wish to sit, I will say, anywhere, so that I am neither a Negro nor a woman. Confer on me, great angel, the glory of white manhood, so that henceforth I may feel unlimited freedom." Adding to the confusion, restrictions on citizenship were unevenly enforced, as is made clear in the evidence of passport applications. The United States issued its first passport in 1782, but for a long time, passports were issued not only by the federal government, but also, and more usually, by states and cities, by governors, by mayors, and even by neighborhood notary publics. Moreover, not all citizenship documents took the form of passports. Black sailors were commonly issued something known as a Seaman's Protection Certificate, declaring that the bearer was a citizen of the United States of America. Frederick Douglass used one of these certificates to make his escape from slavery. There existed, too, in the land of slavery, a proof of identity that served more like a certificate of non-citizenship, an anti-passport, a slave pass, a paper signed by a slave owner, needed by any enslaved person moving through land controlled by slave patrols, armed bands of white men formed into militias. A black man identified as a free person of color, a term adopted from the French gens de couleur libre, and regularly used in the United States beginning in 1810, first obtained a passport in 1835. But that same year, the Supreme Court considered the question of whether a passport is also a proof of citizenship and declared that it was not. This hodgepodge only gradually yielded to a more uniform system. In 1856, Congress passed a law declaring that only the Secretary of State may grant and issue passports, and that only citizens could obtain them. In August of 1861, Lincoln's Secretary of State, William Seward, issued this order: "Until further notice, no person will be allowed to go abroad from a port of the United States without a passport, either from this department or countersigned by the Secretary of State." From then until the end of the war, this restriction was enforced. Its aim was to prevent men from leaving the country in order to avoid military service. In 1866, a State Department clerk wrote that in the issuing of passports, there is no distinction made in regard to color, a policy well ahead of federal citizenship law, but it was just the sort of thing that led Congress to send those two legal scholars into the law books looking, in vain, for a definition of the word citizen. The Civil War raised fundamental questions, not only about the relationship between the states and the federal government, but also about citizenship itself and about the very notion of a nation-state. What is a citizen? What powers can a state exert over its citizens? Is suffrage a right of citizenship or a special right available only to certain citizens? Are women citizens? And if women are citizens, why aren't they voters? What about Chinese immigrants pouring into the West? They were free. Were they under American law? Free white persons, or free persons of color, or some other sort of persons? In the decades following the war, these questions would be addressed by a new party system and a new political order, while a newly empowered and authorized federal government supported the growth of industrial capitalism, which in turn produced inequalities of income and wealth that shook the foundation of the republic. In that new political order, corporations would claim to be, in the eyes of the law, persons, and the dispossessed, the farmers and factory workers who were left behind, would found a political party that insisted on their preeminent authority as the people. In 1866, Congress searched in vain for a well-documented definition of the word citizen. Over the next 30 years, that definition would become clear, and it would narrow. In 1896, the U.S. Passport Office in the Department of State, which had grown to thousands of clerks, began processing applications according to new rules governing the application of passports, which required evidence of identity, including a close physical description, age, years, stature, feet, inches, English measure, forehead, eyes, nose, mouth, chin, hair, complexion, face, as well as affidavits, signatures, witnesses, an oath of loyalty, and by way of an application fee, $1. In the unruly aftermath of the Civil War, the citizen was defined, described, measured, and documented, and the modern administrative state was born. 1. The Union's defeat of the Confederacy granted to the federal government unprecedented powers. The government exerted over the former soldiers of the Confederacy the powers of a victor over the vanquished. Over former slaves, it exerted powers designed to guarantee civil rights in an attempt to thwart the efforts of southern states, which were determined to deny those rights to freedmen and women. Long before the war ended, black men and women tried to anticipate and influence the government's post-war plans. Their priorities were clear: citizenship and property. In March 1863, Edward Stanton, Lincoln's Secretary of War, established the American Freedmen's Inquiry Commission. Its investigators reported that the chief object of ambition among the refugees is to own property, especially to possess land, if it only be a few acres. In October 1864, in Syracuse, New York, the National Convention of Colored Men called for full measure of citizenship for black men, not women, and for legislative reforms that included allowing colored men from all sections of the country to settle on lands granted to citizens by the federal government through the Homestead Act. The Homestead Act, signed into law in 1862, had made available up to 160 acres of unappropriated public lands to individuals or heads of families who would farm them for 5 years and then pay a small fee. Thaddeus Stevens, a craggy-faced Pennsylvanian, led the self-styled Radical Republicans, that wing of the party staunchly committed to reconstructing the political order of Southern society. Stevens, who had been chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee under Lincoln, wanted to confiscate and distribute nearly 400 million acres of Confederate land from some 70,000 of the Confederacy's chief rebels and distribute 40 acres to every adult freedman. The Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands, more generally known as the Freedmen's Bureau, supplied food and clothing to war refugees and to aid the settlement of freed people. But at freedmen's conventions, rumors spread that the Bureau intended to give each freedman 40 acres and a mule. "I picked out my mule," Sam McCallum, a Mississippi ex-slave, later told an interviewer. "All of us did." As the war neared its close, Congress debated how to govern the peace. What should happen to the leaders of the Confederacy? Would they still have the rights of citizens? What should happen to their property? Thaddeus Stevens insisted that the federal government had to treat the former Confederacy as a conquered people and reform the foundation of their institutions, both political, municipal, and social, or else all our blood and treasure will have been spent in vain. But Lincoln was opposed to a vindictive peace, fearing it would prevent the nation from binding its wounds. He proposed instead the so-called 10% plan, which included pardoning Confederate leaders and allowing a state to re-enter the Union when 10% of its voters had taken an oath of allegiance. Radical Republicans in Congress rejected that plan, and at the end of 1864 passed the Wade-Davis Bill, which required a majority of voters to swear that they had never supported the Confederacy, and which would have meant the complete disenfranchisement of all former Confederate leaders and soldiers. Lincoln vetoed the bill. He did, however, eventually agree to place the South under military rule. After Lincoln was assassinated and his vice president, Andrew Johnson, assumed the presidency, Johnson, a square-built former governor of Tennessee, attempted to turn the tide of the post-war plan, plotting a course markedly different from Lincoln's. Lincoln had chosen Johnson as his running mate in an effort to offer reassurance to border states. With Lincoln's death, Johnson set for himself the task of protecting the South. He talked not about Reconstruction, but about restoration. He wanted to bring the Confederate states back into the Union as fast as possible, and to leave matters of citizenship and civil rights to the states to decide. Freedmen continued to press their claims. Union leagues, Republican clubs, and equal rights leagues held freedmen's conventions, demanding full citizenship, equal rights, suffrage, and land, and complaining about the amnesties and pardons issued by Johnson to former Confederate leaders. 4/5 of our enemies are paroled or amnestied, and the other 1/5 are being pardoned, declared one assembly of black men in Virginia, charging Johnson with having left us entirely at the mercy of these subjugated but unconverted rebels and everything save the privilege of bringing us, our wives, and little ones to the auction block. By the winter of 1865 to 66, Southern legislatures, consisting of former secessionists, had begun passing black codes, new racially based laws that effectively continued slavery by way of indentures, sharecropping, and other forms of service. In South Carolina, children whose parents were charged with failing to teach them habits of industry and honesty were taken from their families and placed with white families as apprentices in positions of unpaid labor. Slavery seemed like a monster that each time it was decapitated, grew another head. And then rose the Ku Klux Klan, founded in Tennessee in 1866, a fraternal organization of Confederate veterans who dressed in white robes in order to appear, according to one original Klansman, as the ghosts of the Confederate dead who had risen from their graves in order to wreak vengeance. The Klan really was a resurrection, not of the Confederate dead, but of the armed militias that had long served as slave patrols, that for decades had terrorized men, women, and children with fires, ropes, and guns, instruments of intimidation, torture, and murder. On February 2, 1866, the Senate passed the Civil Rights Act, the first federal law to define citizenship. All persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power, excluding Indians not taxed, are hereby declared to be citizens of the United States, it began. It declared that all citizens have a right to equal protection under the law. Its provisions included extending the Freedmen's Bureau. 5 days after the Senate vote, a crucial, pivotal moment, Frederick Douglass visited the White House to seek the president's support during an extraordinarily tense meeting, a confrontation as remarkable and historic as any that has happened in those halls. "You are placed in a position where you have the power to save or destroy us," Douglass told the president. "I mean, our whole race." Johnson, in a rambling, evasive, and self-justifying speech, assured Douglass that he was a friend to black people. "I have enslaved and bought slaves," he said, "but I never sold one." In truth, Johnson had no intention of taking a stand against black codes, or debating equal rights, or signing a Civil Rights Act. After Douglass left, Johnson scoffed to an aide, "He's just like any nigger and would sooner cut a white man's throat than not." In March, after the House passed the Civil Rights Act, Johnson vetoed it. In April, Congress overrode Johnson's veto. A landmark in the history of the struggle for power between the executive and legislative branches of the federal government, Congress's stand marked the first time that Congress had ever overridden a presidential veto. As the federal government acted to define citizenship and protect civil rights, Johnson tried to halt those changes, but proved unable to triumph over the radical Republicans who dominated Congress and stood at the center of national power. As radical Republicans turned to the question of voting, they began work on constitutional amendments designed to prevent the disenfranchisement of freedmen, the 14th and 15th Amendments. There were ideals at stake, of course, making good on the promise of the nation's founding documents and the cause for which the war was fought. But there was also a matter of raw politics. The abolition of slavery rendered the 3/5 clause obsolete. With each black man, woman, and child counting not as 3/5 of a person, but as 5/5, Southern states gained seats in Congress. Black men, if they were able to vote, were almost guaranteed to vote Republican. For Republicans in Congress to maintain their hold on power, then, they needed to be sure the Southern states didn't stop black men from voting. In pursuing this end, radical Republicans were supported by the legions of women who had fought for abolition and emancipation and for women's rights. After Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation and after ratification of the 13th Amendment, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony had begun to fight, equally hard, for the next amendment, which they expected to guarantee the rights and privileges of citizenship for all Americans, including women. The 14th Amendment, drafted by the Joint Committee on Reconstruction, marked the signal constitutional achievement of a century of debate and war, of suffering and struggle. It proposed a definition of citizenship guaranteeing its privileges and immunities and ensuring equal protection and due process to all citizens. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside, it began. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. During the drafting of the amendment, the committee betrayed the national phalanx of women who for decades had fought for abolition and for black civil rights by proposing to insert into the amendment's second section a provision that any state that denied the right to vote to any of the male inhabitants of such state would lose representation in Congress. Male had never before appeared in any part of the Constitution. "If that word male be inserted," Stanton warned, "it will take us a century at least to get it out." She was not far wrong. Women protested. "Can anyone tell us why the great advocates of human equality forget that when they were a weak party and needed all the womanly strength of the nation to help them on, they always united the words, 'without regard to sex, race, or color?'" asked Ohio-born reformer Francis Gage. Charles Sumner offered this answer. "We know how the Negro will vote, but are not so sure of the woman." How women would vote was impossible to know. Would black women vote the way black men voted? Would white women vote like black women? Republicans decided they'd rather not find out. "This is the Negro's hour," they told women. "May I ask just one question based on the apparent opposition in which you place the Negro and the woman?" Stanton asked Wendell Phillips. "My question is this. Do you believe the African race is composed entirely of males?" Over the protests of women, the word male stayed in the draft. But another term raised more eyebrows. "All persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens. Why persons?" To men who were keen to deny women equal rights, persons seemed oddly expansive. Was there a way in which this amendment could be read, even with the word male, to support female claims for equal rights? During the Senate debate, Jacob Howard, a Republican from Michigan, explained that the amendment protects the black man in his fundamental rights as a citizen with the same shield which it throws over the white man. Howard assured his fellow senators the amendment most emphatically did not guarantee black men the right to vote, even though he wished that it did. It only suggested, without providing any mechanism for enforcement, that states that barred men from voting would lose representation in Congress. On this point, Howard quoted James Madison, who'd written that those who are to be bound by laws ought to have a vote in making them. From the floor, Reverdy Johnson, a Democrat from Maryland, rose to ask how far such a proposition could logically be extended, especially given the amendment's use of the word person. Mr. Johnson: "Females as well as males?" Mr. Howard: "Mr. Madison does not say anything about females." Mr. Johnson: "Persons." Mr. Howard: "I believe Mr. Madison was old enough and wise enough to take it for granted that there was such a thing as the law of nature, which has a certain influence even in political affairs, and that by that law, women and children are not regarded as equals of men." It would take a century for this matter to reach Congress again, and then, only accidentally, during the debate over the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Yet even with the 14th Amendment's extension of certain protections only to male inhabitants, and its narrowed understanding of the rights of persons, ratification was by no means assured. Andrew Johnson opposed the amendment and urged Southern states not to ratify it. Only Tennessee ratified. Always ambivalent about the Confederacy and the last state to secede, Tennessee became the first readmitted to the Union. Meanwhile, in the fall of 1866, radical Republicans were elected to Congress in huge numbers, cutting down Johnson at his knees. And yet from his knees, still he swung at them. Republicans, deeming the expansion of federal power the only possible way to ensure the civil rights of former slaves, passed four Reconstruction Acts. Johnson, swinging wildly, vetoed all four. Congress overrode each of his vetoes, crushing the president into the ground. The Reconstruction Acts divided the former Confederacy into five military districts, each ruled by a military general. Each former rebel state was to draft a new constitution, which would then be sent to Congress for approval. In an act of constitutional coercion, Congress made readmission to the Union contingent on the ratification of the 14th Amendment. Under the terms of Reconstruction,